Chapter 6. 9/10 of the Law. Tarnhelm. Adoratrice. Though its original purpose had been subverted, the so-called quiet order of the Sons of Horus still met in secret. The dormitory halls had once housed thousands of deckhands, but only echoes dwelled here in the normal run of things. Before Istvan, a time that no longer held meaning for the Legion, the Lodge had met only as often as campaign necessity allowed. It had been an indulgence, permitted by the Primarch, encouraged even, but always subservient to the demands of war. Now it met regularly as the Sons of Horus learned more of the secret arts. Close to 1,000 warriors gathered in the long vaulted chamber, an army of sea-green plate, transverse helm crests and crimson mantles. War-blackened banners hung from the dormitory arches, and bloody trophies were speared on long pike shafts along the chamber's length. Wide bowls of promethium billowed chemical fumes and orange flame. A slow drumbeat of fists on thighs echoed from the walls of stone and steel. The sense of anticipation was palpable. Sergar Targost felt it too, but he forced himself to keep his steps measured and his bearing regal. The captain of the 7th Company was broad and powerful, as were all legionaries, but there was a density to him that gave sparring partners pause when they drew his name in the training cages. His blunt features were not those of a true son, and the old scar bisecting his forehead had been overwritten by a more heinous wound. An Iron Hands Terminator had struck him in the dying moments of Istvan V, and the impact trauma had almost ended him there and then. The enclosing pressure of his helm had kept the broth of his brain from oozing through the pulverized ruin of his skull. The apothecaries had sutured the bone fragments together beneath the skin, fixing the largest shards in place with dozens of tensile anchors on the surface of his face. With Lev Goshen's help, Targost had attached the ebon claws torn from the scaled pelt of a dead salamander to the protruding ends of the anchors, giving him the spiked features of a madman. He could no longer wear a battle helm, but Targost considered it an acceptable trade-off. Targost moved through the Sons of Horus, pausing now and then to observe their labours. Sometimes he would offer instruction on the precise angle of a blade, the correct syntax of Colchisian grammar forms, or the required pronunciation of a ritual mantra. The air sang with potential, as though a secret symphony existed just beyond the threshold of perception and would soon burst through into life. Targost smiled. Only a few short years ago, he would have mocked the absurd poetry of such a sentiment. Yet there was truth to it. Tonight would see the Lodge change from a fraternity of dabblers into an order favoured by the touch of primordial truth. Everyone here knew it, and none more so than Malagurst. The War Master's equerry entered the chamber via one of the vertical transit spines, clad in a long chasuble of ermine over his battle plate. Malagurst gave a respectful nod. No rank structure existed within the quiet order save that of Lodge Master, and even the War Master's equerry had to respect that office. "Equerry," said Targost as Malagurst limped to accompany him. "Lodge Master," replied Malagurst, turning to match Targost's pace, despite the fused mass of bone and cartilage within his pelvis and lower spine that stubbornly refused to heal. He walked with the aid of an ebony cane, topped with an amber pummel stone. But Targost suspected the equerry's wounding was no longer as debilitating as he made out. "I doubt there is a more abandoned space aboard the vengeful spirit," said Malagurst with a grin. "You realize, of course, that the Lodge has no more need to hide itself in shadows." Targost nodded. "I know, but old habits, you understand?" "Absolutely," agreed Malagurst. "Traditions must be maintained, even more so now." Malagurst had earned the sobriquet the Twisted for having a mind that wove labyrinthine intrigues around the War Master, but the old nickname had assumed a more literal connotation in the opening shots of the war-making on Terra. The other Terra, where the misguided fool who believed himself emperor had stood against the Sons of Horus. No, Targost reminded himself, back then the Legion had still been the Lunar Wolves, their name not yet reflecting the honour of the warrior that led them. Malagurst had healed, and despite the poor taste of the old nickname, he desired it kept. They moved through the throng, and as news of Malagurst's arrival spread, the warriors parted before them to reveal their destination. Atop a raised plinth marked with chalked geometric symbols stood two structural beams welded together to form an X. Chained to the cross was a legionary stripped of his armour with his head fixed in place by a heavy iron clamp across his brow. Gare Geradon, late of Tithonius' assault, he'd taken two Chagorian tulwars through the lungs on Dwell, and by the time the apothecaries got to him, his oxygen-starved brain was irrevocably damaged. Nothing remained of the man he had once been, just a drooling meat form who could serve no useful purpose within the Legion. Until now. 16 hooded lodge members, arranged in a circle around Geradon, held weeping captives taken in the assault on Tijun. Highborns, for the most part, some native to Dwell, some imperial imports, men and women who'd thrown themselves on the mercy of the Sons of Horus, only to find they had none to give. In any conventional war, they would be bargaining chips, tools of negotiation. But here, they were something altogether more valuable. They sobbed and debased themselves with begging or attempts at bargaining, while others offered their loyalty or things far more precious. A reverent hush descended on the chamber as Malagurst and Targost stepped onto the plinth. Malagurst made a meal out of his step, and Targost shook his head at the equerry's theatrics. "Let's get this done," said Targost, holding out his hand. Malagurst shook his head. "You can't simply rush this, Lodge Master," he said. "I know you are all about the fundamentals, but this is not a breach to be stormed. Ritual is everything here, Sergar. The proper order of things must be observed, the right words spoken and the offerings made at precisely the right time." "Just give me the knife," said Targost. "You speak the words and tell me when to open their throats." The captives wailed, and their captors tightened their grips. Malagurst produced a long dagger from within his robes, its blade curved and worked from dark stone. Its surface was chipped and crude, like something hacked from the ground by savages, but Targost knew its edge to be sharper than any arming chamber tech could match. "Is that," he began, "one of the blades Erebus crafted?" said Malagurst. "No, not that one, of course, but one like it." Targost nodded and took the blade, testing its heft and flexing his fingers on the leather-wrapped handle. It felt good in his grip. Natural. Made for him. "I like it," he said, and turned to Gare Geradon. Like him, Geradon wasn't a true son, his features bearing a malnourished sharpness from a Chthonian childhood that no amount of gen-hancing could ever restore. "A loyal member of the Lodge and a ferocious killer," said Targost. "A man born for assault duties. It's a blow to the Legion to have lost his sword arm. If I have the truth of it, that Ger will fight alongside his brothers with a new soul within him. What the 17th Legion call a demon?" "An old term, but as good a word as any," agreed Malagurst. "Lorcar's sons call their twin flames the Gal Vorbach. Ours will be the Lupercai, the brothers of the wolf." Geradon's eyes were open but unseeing. His lips parted as though he was trying to speak, and drool spilled onto his chest. "Nothing of the man we know remains," said Malagurst. "This will restore him." "Then let's get it done," snapped Targost. Malagurst stood before Geradon, placing a tattooed hand on his scarred chest. Targost didn't remember the Twisted having tattoos, but recognized their provenance. The books Erebus had shown him, the ancient texts said to have been born to Colchis from old Earth, had been filled with stanzas of Artes rendered in the same runic script. "Be ready with that knife, Sergar," said Malagurst. "Have no fear on that score," Targost assured him. Malagurst nodded and began to speak, but in no language Targost had ever heard. The more the equerry spoke, the less Targost believed it was a language in any sense that he could comprehend. He saw Malagurst's mouth moving, but the motion of his lips wasn't matching the noise in Targost's ears. Like rusted metal grating on stone, a death rattle and a tuneless singer combined. Targost coughed a wad of mucus. He tasted blood and spat onto the deck. He blinked away a momentary dizziness and tightened his grip on the stone dagger as the bile in his stomach climbed his gullet. Targost's eyes widened as noxious black smoke streamed from the blade. The miasma clung to its edges, and Targost felt the weight of murder in the dagger's long existence. The temperature plummeted, his very exhalation visible as a long plume of breath. "Now," said Malagurst, and the 16 hooded warriors pulled the captives' heads back to expose their necks. Targost stepped towards the nearest, a young man with handsome features and wide, terrified eyes.
"Please, I just..."
Targost didn't let him finish, and plunged the smoke-edged dagger deep into his throat. Blood fountained from the grotesque wound. The hooded warrior pushed the dying man forward, and Targost moved on, opening one throat after another with no heed of his victim's horror or last words. As the last one died, their blood lapped around Targost's boots and spilled over the edge of the plinth. The chalked symbols drank deeply, and Targost felt a tremor in his hand.
"Mal,"
he said as his arm lifted the blade to his own throat. Malagurst didn't respond, his lips still twisting in opposition to the unsounds he was making. Targost twisted his head, but the world around him was a frozen tableau.
"Malagurst," repeated Targost.
"He can't help you," said Ger Garadon.
Targost looked into a face alight with malice and perverse enjoyment of suffering. No longer slack with brain death, Garadon's features were pulled in a rictus grin. His eyes were milky white and empty, like the unpainted eyes of a doll. Whatever their ritual had drawn from the warp was not Ger Garadon, but something incalculably old, raw-birthed, and bloody.
16. That's the best you could do," it said. 16 measly souls.
"It's a sacred number," hissed Targost, fighting to keep the blade from reaching his neck.
Despite the freezing temperatures, sweat ran in runnels down his face.
"To whom?"
"To us, the Legion," grunted Targost. "We're the 16th Legion, the Twin Octed."
"Ah, I see," said the warp thing. "Sacred to you, but meaningless to the Neverborn. After everything Erebus taught you people, you still manage to get it wrong."
Anger touched Targost, and the blade's inexorable path to the pulsing artery in his neck slowed.
"Wrong? We summoned you, didn't we?"
The thing wearing Garadon's flesh laughed.
"You didn't summon me? I came back of my own accord. I have so much to teach you."
"Come back?" said Targost. "Who are you?"
"I'm hurt you don't recognize me, Serga."
The smoking edges of the gore-encrusted blade touched Targost's neck. Skin parted before its razor tip. Blood pumped as he pushed it deeper into his neck.
"Who am I?"
rasped the demon.
"I'm Tarmageddon."
Rasua flew the pathfinders from old Himalazia to Ultima Thule, the outermost structure still considered to be in Terran orbit. Discounting the as-yet-unfinished Ardent Reef, Ultima Thule was the most recent addition to the inhabited places that made stately circuits around humanity's birthrock. Smaller than the supercontinent of Lemuria, less productive than the industrial powerhouse of Rodinia, and without the grandiose architecture of Antilia, Val Barra, or Kanyakumari. It had been constructed 62 years previously by workers since assigned to distant sectors of the Imperium. Eclipsed in scale and power by its grander brethren, its entry in the Terran Orbital Registry was little more than a footnote. Over the course of its life, Ultima Thule had been quietly forgotten by the vast majority of Terra's inhabitants, and where most orbital architects would lament such a fate for their creation, anonymity had always been the goal of Ultima Thule. Its structure comprised a pair of matte black cylinders, 500 meters in length and 200 wide, connected by a central orb hub. No armored windows pierced its structure, and no collision avoidance lights strove to warn of its presence. Any spacefarer lucky enough to catch a glimpse of Ultima Thule could be forgiven for mistaking it for dead orbital junk. That appearance was deliberately misleading, for Ultima Thule was one of the most sophisticated structures orbiting Terra, its endless suites of Auspecs quietly monitoring spatial traffic throughout the system. A docking bay opened on its dark side, remaining visible only as long as it took to retrieve the void-capable Valkyrie. Auspec's hardened blast doors shut behind the assault carrier, and Ultima Thule continued its procession around the planet below as though it had never existed. Anonymous and forgotten. Silent and invisible. just as Malkador had decreed when he ordered it built. The repository was cool, the air kept at a constant relative humidity and temperature. The more fragile artifacts stored here were hermetically sealed in stasis fields, and Malkador tasted the tang of the recessed power generators. Crystal-fronted cabinets lit up at his passing, but he spared their contents little notice. A book that had once plunged the world into war, sketches by the polymath of Firenze, the Emperor had, wisely it turned out, deemed too dangerous for Pityrabo to see, the half-formed sculpture of beauty incarnate. Malkador had lied when he told young Khalid Hassan that these rough-formed walls were all that remained of the Sigillite fortress, but some truths were uncomfortable enough without burdening others with them. The chamber was smaller than those that surrounded it, and it took Malkador a moment only to reach the stela of Gyptia. It sat on a reinforced timber cradle, the black gloss of its original construction undimmed by the passage of millennia. Lives had been lost to retrieve this fragment of humanity's soul, as was the case with many of the objects stored here. Malkador closed his eyes and placed his fingertips upon the cold surface of the stone. Granodiorite, an igneous rock similar to granite, hard-wearing but not indestructible. Given what it had unlocked in ages past, there was a pleasing symmetry to what it now allowed him to do. Malkador's breathing slowed, and the already cooled air chilled yet further.
"My lord," he said.
Silence was Malkador's only answer, and he feared the holocaust raging beneath the palace was too fierce, too all-consuming for a reply. Beneath wasn't strictly speaking correct, but it was the only preposition that seemed to fit.
"Malkador."
The Emperor's voice echoed within his mind, stentorian and dominant, yet familiar and fraternal. Malkador felt its power, even over so immeasurable a distance, but also the effort it was taking to forge the link.
"How goes the fight?"
"We bleed out every day, while the demons grow ever stronger. I do not have much time, my friend. War calls."
"Lehman Rus is on Terra," said Malkador.
"I know. Even here I can feel the Wolf King's presence."
"He brings word of the Lion. 20,000 Dark Angels are reportedly bound for Ultramar."
"Why does he not make haste for Terra?"
Sweat ran down Malkador's back at the strain of maintaining this connection.
"There are unsettling rumours of what is happening in Gilliman's domain."
"I cannot see the 500 worlds. Why is that?"
"We call it the Ruin Storm. Nemo and I believe the slaughter on Kalth to have been part of an orchestrated chain of events that precipitated the birth of a catastrophic and impenetrable warp storm."
"And what do you believe Roboot is doing?"
"It's Gilliman. What do you think he's doing? He's building an empire."
"And the Lion goes to stop him?"
"So the Wolf King says, my lord. It seems the warriors of the Lion stand with us after all."
"You doubted them? The first? Even after all they accomplished in the time before the others took up their swords?"
"I did," admitted Malkador. "After Rogal's secret emissaries to their home world returned empty-handed, we feared the worst. But Caliban's angels came to the wolves' aid when Alpharius threatened to destroy them."
"Alpharius, my son, what chance did you give my dream? Ah, even when war presses in from all sides, my sons still seek to press their advantage. They are like the feudal lords of old, scenting opportunity for their own advancement in the fires of adversity."
The regret pained Malkador's thoughts.
"Rus still plans to fight Taurus eye to eye," said Malkador. "He sends my knights to guide his blade, and no words of mine can sway him from his course."
"You think he should not fight Taurus?"
"Rus is your executioner," said Malkador tactfully, "but his axe falls a little too readily these days. Magnus felt it. Now Horus will feel it."
"Two rebel angels. His axe falls on those deserving its smile."
"And what happens when Rus takes it upon himself to decide who is loyal and who deserves execution?"
"Rus is true-hearted. one of the few I know, will never fall.
You suspect others may prove false?
To my eternal regret, I do.
Who?
Another long pause made Malkador fear his question would remain unanswered, but at last the Emperor replied,
"The Khan makes a virtue of being unknowable, of being the mystery that none can answer. Some among his legion have already embraced treachery, and others may yet."
"What would you have me do, my lord?"
"Keep watching him, Malkador. Watch the Khan more closely than any other."
"I have never wanted to fly anything so much in all my life," said Rasua,
looking at the sleek wedge-shaped craft with its jutting, aerodyne prow. Loken couldn't help but agree with her.
"I'm told it's called Tarnhelm," he said. "Call it what you want, but if I'm not flying it within the hour, there's going to be blood spilled," said Rasua.
Loken grinned at her eagerness. He disliked aircraft on principle, but even he recognized something beautiful in the Tarnhelm. Perhaps because it looked so utterly unlike any other aircraft in the Legione's Astartes inventory, the warcraft of the legions were designed to be brutal, in appearance as well as effect. Their form followed function, which was to kill as quickly and efficiently as possible. Tarnhelm's sleek lines spoke of an altogether different purpose. Its basic structure was constructed around a central crew section with bulbous drive pods at the rear that tapered towards the prow and formed the ship's delta-winged shape. Without any pennants or beacons, there was nothing to give any clue to its identity or affiliation.
"What is it?" asked Farron. "It's not an attack ship or a gun cutter. Too few armaments. And there's not enough armor for it to be a troop transport. One good hit is going to gut it. I don't understand what it is."
"This is a craft designed to pass through the stars unseen," said Rama Karian,
and all eyes turned to look at him, as it was the most any of them had heard him say.
"Why in the world would you want to do that?"
asked Kalyan Zaven, his expression as confused as Varan's.
"The point of the legions is to be seen."
"Not always," said Alton Nohai. "What the Khan called a clever fighter is one who not only wins, but excels in winning with ease before the enemy even knows he is there."
Zaven looked unconvinced.
"Shock and awe becomes a lot harder when no one sees it coming."
"It's got teeth, mind," said Aris Wojtek,
his servo arms unlimbering to point out the barely visible seams of recessed weapon nacelles and missile pods.
"But as Mesa says, it's not an attack ship."
"It's a Draugrijuka," said Bror Tyrfinger.
Seeing the looks of confusion among his fellow pathfinders, Bror shook his head and said,
"Don't you people understand Uvik?"
"Uvik?"
asked Rubio.
"Fenrisian Hearthcant," said Tubal Cain. "It's a stripped-down, simplified language, no subtlety to it, punchy and declarative, just like the warriors that speak it."
"Have a care, Tubal," warned Bror, squaring his shoulders. "A man could take offence at that."
That seemed to confuse Cain.
"I don't see how. Nothing I said was untrue. I've met enough space wolves to know that."
Loken expected anger, but Bror laughed.
"Space wolves? Huh? I forgot that was your idiot name for the rout. If I didn't think you were being completely serious, I'd rip your arms off. Stay by my side and I'll show you just how subtle a space wolf can be." "So, what's a Draugrijuka?" asked Loken.
"A ghost ship," said Bror.
A grey-robed servile with augmetic implants worn around her skull like a tonsure had met the pathfinders in the docking bay, and she now led them aboard the Tarnhelm. The vessel's interior was stripped back, with only the barest minimum of fitments that would allow it to carry crew. Its astropath was kept in sealed cryostasis, and its navigator had yet to be implanted in the tapered cupola on the dorsal section. The long axis of the ship was a cramped dormitory, with alcoves serving as medicay bays, equipment stowage, and sleeping areas. Individual crew compartments were set towards the rear of the craft, with a slender nave reaching from the communal areas of the ship to its tapered prow. Rasua made her way towards the bridge, while the rest of the pathfinders stowed their equipment in cunningly arranged lockers and weapon racks. The knight's errand had been extant only a short while,
too short for any real traditions to bed in, but a custom that had been readily adopted was for each warrior to retain a single artifact from his former legion. Loken thought back to the battered metal crate in which he had kept his meagre belongings, the garrotting wire, the feathers, and the broken combat blade. Junk to any other eyes than his, but there had been one item whose loss had grieved him. The data slate Ignace Carcassi had given him, the one from Euphrates Keeler, that had been a treasure beyond value, a record of the time when the universe made sense, when the lunar wolves had been a byword for honour, nobility, and brotherhood. Like everything else he had once owned, it was gone. He snapped his chainsword into the locker's blade rack, careful to fix it in place. Its blade was fresh from a manufacturing city in Albion and inscribed with a boast that it was warranted never to fail, just like the thousands of others forged there. His bolter was no different, the product of manufactories geared for war on a galactic scale, where the ability to mass-produce reliable weaponry was of far greater importance than any considerations of individuality. Lastly, he placed the mirror token Severian had given him into the locker. Loken had thought about throwing them away, but some fatalistic instinct told him that he might yet have need of them. He closed the locker, watching as the rest of his Pathfinder stowed their gear. Tubal Cain unpacked a piece of surveying gear, a modified theodolite with multiple Auspex capabilities. Rama carried on a rifle with an elongated barrel and oversized sight. Ares Wojtek had his servo harness with its burnished gauntlet icon, and Bror Tyrfinger stowed what appeared to be a leather cestus gauntlet of entwined knotwork with ebon claws like knife blades. Kalyon Zaven appeared at Loken's side, opening the locker next to him and slotting home a custom-worked bolt gun with a clawed wing motive acid-etched onto its platework. Within the Lunar Wolves, such weapons had been for officers, but the killing fields of murder had shown Loken that many of the warriors of the Third Legion wielded heavily embellished armaments. Zaven saw Loken's attention and said, "A poor effort, I know. Not a patch on my original bolter." "That's not your touchstone?" "Thrown, no," said Zaven, unbuckling his hand-tooled leather sword belt and holding it between them. "This is my touchstone." The sword's handle was tightly wound golden wire, its pummel an ebony talon. The quillons were swept eagle wings with a glittering amethyst mounted at the centre of both sides. "Draw it," said Zaven. Loken did so, and his admiration for the weapon increased tenfold. The weapon had heft, but was incredibly light. The handle and setting had been wrought by human hand, but the blade had never known a smith's hammer. Curved like a Chagorian sweep sword, and milky white, dappling to a jaundice yellow at its edge, the blade was clearly organic. "It's a vapor wraith Hewclaw," said Zaven. "Cut it from one of their warrior caste on Jupiter after he'd stuck it through my heart. By the time I got out of the Apothecarian, my legion had already moved on, and I found myself part of the Crusader host for a time. Disappointing, but it gave me the time to work the Hewclaw into a dueling blade. Try it out." "Perhaps another time," said Loken. "Indeed so," replied Zaven, taking no offence as he took the sword back from Loken. He grinned. "I heard how you put down that odious little bastard Lucius. I wish I'd seen that." "It was over quickly," said Loken. "There wasn't much to see." Zaven laughed, and Loken saw glint in his eye that might have been admiration or could have been appraisal. "I don't doubt it. You'll have to tell me about it some day, or perhaps we might match blades on the journey." Loken shook his head. "Don't you think we have enough enemies before us without looking for them in our own ranks?" Zaven put his hands up, and Loken was instantly contrite. "As you wish," said Zaven, his eyes darting to Loken's equipment case. "So, what did you keep?" "Nothing," said Loken, blinking away the after-image of a hooded shadow towards the rear of the compartment. His heartbeat spiked, and droplets of sweat beaded on his forehead. "Come on! Everyone keeps something," grinned Zaven, oblivious to Loken's discomfort. "Rubio has his little gladius. Varon, that woodman's axe, and Cruz keeps that battered old bolt gun, and Cain has whatever grubby engineer's tool that is. Tell me, what did you keep?" Loken slammed his locker shut. "Nothing," he said. "I lost everything on Istvan III. Aside from the times he'd been deflowering his half-brother's wife, Raven had always hated Albard's Tower. Situated in the very heart of Lupercalia, it was a grim edifice of black stone and copper sheeting. The city was in a state of mourning, black flags and the entwined eagle and naga banners hanging from every window. Raven's late father might have been a bastard, but he was at least a bastard who'd earned his people's respect. Raven climbed the stairs slowly, taking his time and savouring this culmination of his desires. Lix and his mother followed behind, as eager as him to consummate this sublime moment. The tower was kept dark. The sacristans assigned to Albard's care claimed his eyes could not tolerate light beyond the dimmest lumen. Raven's spies told him Albard never ventured beyond the tower's top chambers, confined by lunacy and infrequent brushes with moribund lucidity.
"I hope he's rational," said Lix, his sister wife's words seeming to take their cue from Raven's thoughts, as they so often did. "It won't be any fun if he's lost in madness."
"Then you should prepare yourself for disappointment," said Raven. "It's a rare day our brother even knows his own name."
"He will be rational," said his mother, climbing the steps with wheezing mechanical awkwardness.
"How can you be so sure?"
"Because I have seen it," replied his mother, and Raven knew not to doubt her.
That Adoratrice consorts were privy to many secrets was well known all across Molech, but that those of House Divine could witness things not yet come to pass was known only to Lupercalia's knights. The divine Adoratrices had preserved that ability for thousands of years by keeping the gene stock of their house from being diluted by inferior bloodlines. It surprised Raven that Lix had not seen what his mother had, but the ways of the Adoratrice were not his to know. Sibella Divine, his mother, and Adoratrice Dracaena to his father, was now at least 100 years of age. Her husband had rejected cosmetic juvenile treatments for vanity's sake, but Sibella embraced them with gusto. Her skin was lifted back over her skull like tightened plastic, fixed in place with surgical sutures to a grotesque headpiece that resembled a device of skull-violating horror. A hunched pair of biologist servitors followed in Sibella's wake, tethered to her via a series of hissing pipes and feeder tubes. Both were venom-blinded and implanted with numerous monitoring devices and gurgling hissing cylinders containing gel nutrients, anti-senescence compounds and restorative cell cultures harvested from vat-grown newborns. To keep Sibella's brittle bones from undue stresses, an ingenious scaffold of suspensor fields, exolattices and fibre-bundled muscles had been surgically bonded with her skeletal structure.
"You'd better be right,"
snapped Lix, straightening her bronze-panelled dress and arranging her hair.
"It'll be pointless if he's no better than a beast or a vegetable."
Lix had once been wed to Albard, but her vows had been broken even before he'd put his betrothal ring on her. Though it had been their mother that engineered Raven and Lix's relationship, Sibella had a depthless contempt for her daughter that Raven could only attribute to jealousy of her apparent youth.
"It won't be pointless," he said, shutting them both up before they could get into one of their all-too-frequent arguments.
His mother's sickly flesh contorted with what he presumed was a smile, though it was hard to tell.
"After all this time, I want to see the look in his eyes when I tell him I killed his father."
"Your father, too, and mine," pointed out Lix.
Their mother's womb had ejected Raven mere minutes before Lix, but sometimes it felt like decades. Today was such a day.
"I am aware of that," he said, pausing just before he reached the upper landing of the tower. "I want him to see the woman who replaced his own mother on one side, his former wife on the other. I want him to know that everything that was and should have been his is now mine."
Lix slipped her arm through his, and his mood lightened. As she had done since they were suckled babes, she knew his moods and needs better than he. To her loving populace, her beauty and body were sustained by calisthenics and subtle juvenile treatments. Raven knew better. Many of his wife's long absences into Lupercalia's hidden valleys were spent undergoing nightmarish chirurgical procedures administered by Shargali Shi and his coven of androgyne serpent cultists. Raven had witnessed one such operation, a dreadful blend of surgery, alchemy, and carnal ritual, and vowed never to do so again. The ovulator claimed to channel the Vril-Ya, the power of the serpent gods once worshipped all across Molech in an earlier age. Raven didn't know if that was true or not, but the results spoke for themselves.
Though nearly 65, Lix could easily pass for less than half that.
The serpent moons grow ever fuller, said Lix. Shargali Shi will call the Vril Jarl together soon.
He smiled. A six-day bacchanalia of intoxicating venoms and writhing hedonism within the hidden temple caverns was just what he needed to lighten the coming burden of planetary command. Yes, he said with a grin of anticipation, and all but bounded up the last few steps. The entrance vestibule of the topmost chambers was dark, the two Dawn Guard standing sentinel at the onward doorway little more than dark silhouettes. Despite the poor light, Raven knew both of them, soldiers from his mother's personal detail. He wondered if they'd shared her bed, and judged it more than likely from the conspicuous aversion of their gaze. They stepped aside as Raven approached, one opening the door for him as the other bowed deeply. Raven swept past them and moved through richly appointed antechambers, medicae bays, and chambers of observation. A trio of nervous sacristans awaited them at the entrance to Albard's private rooms. Each was red-robed, in imitation of their mechanicum masters, plugged with bionics and rank with sweat and grease. Not quite cult mechanicum, but too altered to be thought of as human either. If not for their rote maintenance of the knights, Raven would have advocated their elimination years ago.
My lord,
said a sacristan Raven thought was called Onak. Does he know? Said Raven.
No, my lord, said Onak. Your instructions were most precise.
Good. You're a competent sacristan, and it would have irked me to flay you alive. All three sacristans moved aside with alacrity as Raven pushed open the door. The air that gusted from within was musty and stifling, a fetor of urine, flatus, and insanity. A deep couch with a sagging footstool was set on the edge of a dimmed fireplace that was entirely holographic. Upon the couch sat a man who looked old enough to be Raven's grandfather. Denied sunlight and the rejuvenating surgeries of his half-brother, Albard Divine was a wretch of a human being, his skull hairless and pale as newly hatched maggots. Before his mind had snapped, Albard's physique had been robust and stocky, but now he was little more than a drained revenant of parchment-dry flesh, sunken over a rack of misaligned bones. Albard had been cruelly handsome, bluntly so, with the stony harshness people expected of a warrior king. That man was long gone. A gelatinous lesion, emerging from the burn scars he'd received upon his maturity, leaked yellow pus into his long beard. Clotted with mucus and spilled food, the beard reached almost to Albard's waist, and the one eye that stared at the fire was jaundiced and milky with cataracts.
"Is that you, Onak?"
said Albard, his voice a tremulous husk of a thing.
"The fire must be dying. I'm cold."
"He doesn't even realize it's a hologram," thought Raven, and his mother's assurance that his half-brother would be in a state of relative lucidity seemed dashed. "It's me, brother," said Raven, moving to stand beside the couch. The stench of corruption grew stronger, and he wished he'd brought a vial of caban root to waft under his nose.
"Father?"
"No, you idiot," he said. "Listen closely. It's me, Raven."
"Raven?"
said Albard, shifting uneasily on the couch. Something rustled beneath the couch in response to Albard's movement, and Raven saw the thick, serpentine body of Shesha. His father's last surviving Naga shifted position with creaking, leathery motion, a forked tongue flicking from her fanged mouth. Well over 2 centuries old, Shesha was in the last years of her life, near blind, and her long-scaled body already beginning to ossify. "Yes, brother," said Raven, kneeling beside Albard and reluctantly placing a hand on his knee. The fabric of his coverlet was stiff and encrusted, but Raven felt the brittle bird-like bones beneath. A haze of filth billowed from the coverlet, and Raven felt his gorge rise.
"I don't want you here,"
said Albard, and Raven felt a flutter of hope that his half-brother was at least in touching distance of sanity.
"I told them not to let you in."
"I know. But I have something to tell you."
"I don't want to hear it."
"You will?"
"No."
"Father is dead." Albard finally deigned to look at him, and Raven saw himself reflected in that glossy, white, hopeless eye. The augmetic had long since ceased to function.
"Dead?"
"Yes, dead," said Raven, leaning in despite the rancid miasma surrounding Albard. His half-brother blinked his one eye and looked past his shoulder, now aware of the presence of others in the room.
"Who else is here?"
he said, sounding suddenly afraid. "Mother? My mother," said Raven. "And Lix. You remember her?" Albard's head sank back to his chest, and Raven wondered if he drifted off into some Kem-induced slumber. The sacristans kept Albard moderately sedated at all times, to keep the ravaged synapses of his brain from causing an explosive aneurysm within his skull.
"I remember a whore by that name," said Albard, as a rivulet of yellow saliva leaked from the dry gash of his mouth.
Raven grinned as he felt Lix's rising fury. Men had endured days of unimaginable agony for far less.
"Yes, that's her," said Raven.
He'd pay for that later. But more and more he relished the punishment, more than the pleasure.
"Did you kill him?"
said Albard, fixing Raven with his rheumy gaze.
"Did you kill my father?"
Raven looked back over his shoulder as Sibella and Lix drew closer to better savour Albard's humiliation. His mother's features were unmoving, but Lix's cheeks were flushed in the light of the holographic fire.
"I did, yes, and the memory of it still makes me smile," said Raven. "I should have done it a long time ago. The old bastard just wouldn't let go, wouldn't hand me what was rightfully mine."
Albard let out a wheezing exhalation of breath, as dry as winds over the Tazkar steppe. It took a second for Raven to recognize the sound as bitter laughter.
"Rightfully yours. You remember who you're talking to? I'm the firstborn of House Divine."
"Ah, of course," said Raven, standing and wiping his hands on a silk handkerchief he withdrew from his brocaded coat. "Yes, well, it's not like our house can be led by a cripple who can't even bond with his knight, now is it?" Albart coughed into his beard, a dry, hacking wretch that brought up yet more phlegmy matter. When he looked up, his eye was clearer than it had been in decades.
"I've had a lot of time to think over these long years, brother," said Albard when the coughing fit subsided. "I know I could have recovered enough to leave this tower, but you and Lix made sure that never happened, didn't you?"
"Mother helped," said Raven. "So how does it feel, brother, to see everything that should have been yours is now mine?"
"Honestly, I couldn't care less," said Albard. "You think after all this time I care what happens to me? Mother's pet sacristans keep me barely alive, and I know I'll never leave this tower. Tell me, brother, why in the world would I care what you do any more?"
"Then we're done here," said Raven, fighting to keep his anger from showing.
He'd come here to humiliate Albard, but the wretched bastard had been hollowed out too much to appreciate the pain. He turned to face Sibella and Lix.
"Take the blood you need, but make it quick."
"Quick?"
pouted Lix.
"Quick," repeated Raven. "The Lord Generals and the Legions have called for a council of war, and I'll not start my governorship by having anyone doubting my competency."
Lix shrugged and pulled a Naga Fang filleting knife from the many concealed folds of her dress as she stood above the shriveled wraith of her former husband and half-brother.
"Shargali Shi needs the blood of the firstborn," said Lix, dropping to one knee and resting the blade against the side of Albard's neck. "Not all of it, but a lot."
Albard spat in her face.
"This may be quick," she said, wiping her face, "but I promise it will be agonizing."